This is an interview with Dr. Helmut Frank, 7934 Algon Avenue, Philadelphia 19111, phone number 745-5933, on February 19, 1982, with Josie Fisher. Dr. Frank, can you tell me where and when you were born and a little bit about your family?
I was born on April 15th, 1912, in the city of Wiesbaden. My upbringing was Jewish, not Orthodox, but some way traditional. My great-grandfather was a rabbi. Not a rabbi with a pulpit, but a Talmudical scholar who made a living by a store whom his wife operated. In addition to that, his wife bore him 10 children and took care of the household so that he could the whole day to take care of his learning and study, and had an easy life. So I'm his great grandson, and while most members of our family were not religious or not interested very much in religion, I was in love. I was in love with Judaism. I was different than everybody else, different than my sister, different than cousins and all other members of the family, or most other members of the family.
Were you able to spend time with this great-grandfather when you were a child?
No. He was not living anymore when I was born, but my grandfather was also very religious. I was influenced by him. Mm-hmm. He was not a learned scholar, but he was a very observant Jew, and I liked his ways of spending time in shul. I liked his laying tefillah in the morning, so observing kashrut, and I was influenced by him, I would say. He was one of this. He died when I was 11 years old.
Was it with this grandfather then that you learned your early Jewish education?
I don't think I learned with him, but he was very much interested that I should that I should get a good Jewish upbringing, and he suggested to my father that he should give a special sum of money to our teacher of religion, so that he would teach me more. But my father didn't like that idea at all. But
did he do that?
He didn't do it, but he would have liked to see it. You know, he was more a Jew in the old-fashioned way.
Now, were your parents members of the synagogue?
Well, in Wiesbaden, where I grew up, there were two Jewish communities. One small one that was Orthodox, and one larger one that was liberal. Today, according to American terms, you would call it conservative. Mm-hmm. There was no reform in Wiesbaden. Altogether in Germany, there was only one reform congregation that was in Berlin that had Sabbath services on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I was also once in that temple to see how they perform services there without hats, as it's done in America, in a reform synagogue. But I think they were much more reformed than the reform congregations in America. Mm-hmm. There were national Germans, felt altogether more German than Jewish. Jewish was only a very small part of their human life. Well, I want to come back now to my own upbringing.
Yes, we were talking now, about your family's involvement.
In comparison to my classmates who received a religious upbringing in special classes, I was the best one. I learned more than them because I was more interested. But from a general point of view of Jewish requirements, I did not learn very much altogether.
Which of the groups did your family belong to?
We belonged to the liberal congregation. Mm-hmm. But my grandfather, when he was in our hometown, he of course wouldn't go there. He went to the Orthodox mm-hmm. congregation. So I was somewhat in between. Sometimes I went there. I think I was one of the few who went to both to both congregations, to both synagogues.
So you're saying that the education that was given in the liberal congregation was not what you would have liked it to have been?
That's correct. The Orthodox, where my wife went, got a better education. Not very much either, but it was they still learned more than we learned.
What was involved in your education? What
you
kind of
the
classes
Jewish education?
That you had in the liberal congregation in Wiesbaden?
Well, we learned Hebrew to read from the prayer book. We learned some Chumash, not too much. But I excelled because I learned whole Sitra. Nobody else did, mm-hmm. because I did that on my own. We learned Jewish history, biblical history, I should say first, Jewish history. I mean, those who were interested could get something out of it. Mm-hmm. Generally, not too many were interested.
What kind of community were you living in Wiesbaden? Was it a Jewish community or was it an integrated area?
Well, Wiesbaden was one of the large German communities. We had 4,000 Jews in Wiesbaden.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, in the time before Hitler, Jews were known among Gentiles. There might have been even some Jews who were friendly with Gentiles. And of course there was intermarriage, not like today 50%, but there was quite a sizable intermarriage at that time. So Jews were, and that then through marriage, friendly with Gentile families, through a personal relationship, family relationship.
Were you in a public school?
Yes, yes. There was no Jewish day school mm-hmm. in my hometown. And since my schooling was finished before the advent of Hitler in 1931, there was no problem as far as Jews attending public schools was concerned. I went through a regular high school that I finished with a diploma in the year 31.
Mm-hmm.
There were incidents, anti-Semitic incidents already at that time.
Can you describe them to me?
Well, people kept away from me because I was Jewish.
Was this still while you were in high school or earlier?
Well, earlier, I do not think there were any anti-Jewish incidents, but in high school, there were people who belonged to national organizations, nationalistic organizations, I should call them, and were not very friendly to Jews. I still remember one incident where one was not nice to me all the time because of his anti-Semitic attitudes, wanted to help during a test, and I refused to help him, and he then handed a note over to me, typical of a typical Jewish.
Mm.
Same person, unfortunately, I should say, was killed in the Second World War. So,
as a child growing up, did you have non-Jewish friends as well as Jewish friends?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, in the beginning of my schooling, I had only Gentile friends. Later on, it changed. We were only three Jews in our class, and one unfortunately died natural causes when he was about 13 years old. Then we were only two, and this one, who this other Jew was in our class, became my best friend. Mm-hmm. Very good friends. He then died about 12 years ago in Israel. Mm. He was in a kibbutz, the guy. Dalia. I visited his widow when I was in Israel in 72, and I'm still friendly with his widow, who wants to visit us here in America during this year. Generally, there were Jews who were well known, who had acquaintances, Gentile acquaintances. I cannot say whether here in America Jews are in better terms with Gentiles, or whether in Germany Jews were more friendly with Gentiles. I do not know.
Were your parents involved with Christian families?
Well,
socially,
we had a cousin who was a Christian, and of course my parents were very friendly with him. Mm-hmm. But he was related to us. Mm-hmm. Through marriage. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I do not think we had any social relationship with Gentiles. I do not remember that we invited them, except this cousin, of course, who my parents liked very much.
And your home was not observant as far as?
Let me call it semi-observant. Especially as long as my grandfather lived with us. He wanted my mother to make him a kosher household.
Uh-huh.
And then as long as he was there, there was something like a kosher home. Later on, when he passed away, I don't think there was much kashrut observance in our house. But we didn't have pig or at least so far. Mm-hmm. Kosher.
Were your parents involved in any Jewish organizations?
Oh, yes.
In the town?
Yes. Oh, there was the B'nai B'rith Lodge, to which my father belonged. My father was very active in Jewish organizations. Mm-hmm. Of course, in addition to the community to which we all belonged by the fact that we were Jews, as it, whether we had to belong, if you wanted to, unless you declared before the court that you want to be a Jew without belonging to the community, you had to belong and pay taxes to the Jewish community. That's different from America.
In the Gemeinde.
That's correct, yeah.
Now, if you did not want to, you had to declare so before a court.
Yeah. For instance, the Orthodox had a special privilege to leave the Gemeinde, and because they formed their own Gemeinde. Mm-hmm. So they had to go, let's say, the parents of my wife, they had to go before, when they moved to Germany, they had to go before a court, before the court in Wiesbaden, no? When the parents of my wife moved to Wiesbaden, they wanted to join the Orthodox community. In order to do so, they had to go before a court and declare that they want to leave the Gemeinde and become members of the Orthodox community.
The court was under whose auspices?
Was a general governmental court.
A German federal governmental court?
Yeah.
I see.
That was a law that came out in the year 1876. Mm-hmm. Under the influence of Samson Raphael Hirsch. Mm-hmm. only in Prussia, not in all of Germany, only in that province of Prussia, that stipulated that any Jew may leave the Jewish community and still remain a Jew. And this was for the benefit of Orthodox people who did not want to contribute money to the general community, because the general community used in their synagogue an organ, and that was against their principles. Mm-hmm. So they could declare, but as I say, only in Prussia, and Wiesbaden was part of Prussia.
Okay. So at what point did you decide that you wanted to go into the rabbinate?
Actually, I wasn't so sure about it at all. And even today, I don't even know whether it was the right thing for me to do. But as I say, I had a love affair with Judaism. And I found this was the only way in which I could learn something, or something more about Judaism. So I felt in order to know as much as possible, the best thing is I attend a rabbinical school. And once I was there already, it was the most natural thing that I slided into that profession. I think I could have lived even without it. I mean, I don't think that was, I felt it was absolutely necessary for me to be a rabbi, but I think as things happened, with the way it turned out.
Which seminary did you attend?
Well, this is a good question you ask me, because in Germany there were three places where you could be or be become an ordained rabbi. One seminary was in Breslau. It was the oldest one. And Berlin had two, one Orthodox and one liberal. Now, you would think that, according to my feeling, it would have been the right thing for me to go to the Orthodox seminary. But I did not, and I could not, because they wouldn't have accepted me.
Why?
Number one, lack of Hebrew knowledge. Number two, a rabbi would have to confirm the fact that I come from an Orthodox family. I did not. So they wouldn't have accepted me. And I don't think, I'm doubtful whether I would have stayed there very long, because the need of learning Talmud was very great, and I know that even some who came from Orthodox families were told that they could not tolerate them because they didn't learn enough Talmud even after they were accepted. So they had no other choice. The only choice I had was between Breslau and Berlin, and everybody told me that Breslau seminary is on a decline downwards, and Berlin is still a good seminary. They had famous teachers there, like Dr. Elbogen, Dr. Goodman, and Dr. Albeck at the time. And so...
This was the Hochschule?
Yeah, Hochschule für die Wissenschaft des Judentums, correct. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I went there from 31 to 37.
Can you tell me about your experience during that time?
Well, actually, I was not too happy there, because the school was very liberal, and I didn't like it, but I had no way of changing it. I mean, the school had not even a mezuzah at the doors. Mm. The school was under the influence of Geiger, that was a founder of the school. I did not find there the atmosphere, the religious atmosphere that I was longing for. Mm-hmm. I didn't find there the type of company that I was longing for. So,
what do you mean by that?
Like-minded people.
The students were of a different nature than...
More or less, yes. I found there one who became my friend, who lives now in Jerusalem. As I mentioned before, his name was Fischer. and he was like me. He came from Poland, and he came actually to the school because he didn't know about the fact that there was another school that was Orthodox. He thought that was the only one that existed.
Okay.
So that's the way he got stuck there.
Were the other students more interested in the scholarly aspects or the academic aspects and not as much in the traditional observance?
Yes, we had very serious scholars in our school, among the teachers as well as among the students, who became later famous through their scholarly work. Others played a daily role in the reform movement. Just now the new Torah came out with the explanations by Rabbi Plaut.
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi Plaut was originally a student of the Hochschule.
Mm-hmm.
And there are quite a number of reform rabbis today who are prominent former students of the Hochschule with whom I had associated there. Others now in the conservative rabbinate.
Was the training, the religious aspect of the training, sufficient, do you feel, in the Hochschule for what you were looking for?
No. Unfortunately, I must say no. We learned Talmud, while I felt the Orthodox were learning too much, we definitely learned too little.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we still could, I still should say we can compete with what is taught today at the Jewish Theological Seminary.
Here?
Here.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned definitely more than is taught at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
When, at one time, Cincinnati took over about after the advent of Hitler in order to help us, took over six volunteers who wanted to go to America. One of them was Plaut, whom I mentioned already before. And as far as their Talmudical knowledge was concerned, they were considered scholars there.
Mm-hmm.
So that shows you how relative everything is in, as far as knowledge is concerned. I personally felt we did not learn enough, not enough time, not enough energy was devoted to us, and not enough understanding for the needs of a student who came from a Western Jewish home.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had there many students who came from Poland and Russia. They knew, many of them knew Talmud very well.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't come there for Talmudical studies. So there was this discrepancy. On the one hand, the German Jewish student who had hardly any knowledge, on the other hand, the Polish-Russian student who was already a scholar when he came to the seminary, the Hochschule.
But unless you came from an Orthodox family and already had some Talmudic knowledge, you were not permitted to go to the Orthodox seminary, from what you're telling me.
That's correct, yes. That's correct.
What?
They were not interested in making any converts or like the Lubavitcher here to,
uh-huh.
in America, no.
You couldn't switch track?
No. In order to go there, if I would have to go there, I would have to go at least, as I learned later, to be made kosher by going to a yeshiva for 1 year.
Uh-huh.
And then maybe would be acceptable.
Mm. Were there academic requirements in any other university in addition to the Hochschule? Did you have to take courses of study in any German university in addition?
Well, in order to be a rabbi in Germany, it was generally done that you had to acquire the PhD degree.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't, you were excluded for the rabbinate,
mm-hmm.
from the rabbinate, but that was the general way. The rabbis in Germany were, I would say, 90-95% at the same time, doctors of philosophy. So it was expected from a student at the Hochschule that he would spend at least half of the time at the Berlin University.
Mm-hmm.
I personally also studied at the Berlin University philosophy and Oriental languages like Arabic, Syriac. And but I went then to the city that is now famous. At that time it wasn't so famous as the capital of Western Germany, Bonn. I went to the city of Bonn, where I graduated as a PhD in the year 1935.
What school was that?
This was the University of Bonn.
University of Bonn.
Yeah.
You were doing this at the same time that you were pursuing your rabbinical studies?
When I went to Bonn for 1 year, I took a leave of absence from the Hochschule for the purpose of doctorate.
Why did you switch to the University of Bonn?
Very simple, because the requirements in the University of Berlin were very difficult. And I felt it was too hard for me to do it. Most of the students did not graduate at the Berlin University. Most of them went either to Bonn or to Würzburg or other university cities where it was a little easier.
You said that it was most prevalent, but it was not required that you have a PhD?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
You could still
be acceptable as a rabbi in Germany without a PhD. But most congregations wanted to call their rabbi Herr Doctor.
As opposed to rabbi?
Herr Rabbiner was not well liked in Germany as a consequence of the emancipation. The name Rabbiner was not very well liked. Also, it would have been acceptable, but generally it belonged to it. It was part of the rabbinical study. You must have university training.
Did you have any experience during those years with either Rosenzweig or Buber or any of the offshoots of the Lehrhaus in Frankfurt?
Well, Rosenzweig died at the time
when
I was a student.
Yes.
Buber was not a teacher in our school, and he also left for Jerusalem. I don't know which year he left Germany, but also early. So I had actually no direct connection with neither Rosenzweig nor Buber.
Mm-hmm. And what about Leo Beck?
Leo Beck, yeah. He was prominent in our school. And I was one of the few who did not fully appreciate him. For very personal reasons, I would say. He kept aloof from the students. He just entered the hall in which he was teaching and gave his lecture or taught us and left again. The only time when I had personal contact with him, and he himself was surprised that he didn't know certain things and I didn't know it, was when I met him in the year 1947 in Philadelphia, and I visited him in his hotel. After all that had passed in all these years, then all of a sudden we felt we had certain things in common, we knew certain things, but while he was a teacher, he did not know anything about me personally, and I had no direct contact with him. This was one thing that disturbed me, his being so far aloof from the students.
From all of the students?
I wouldn't say from all of them, but most of them. Mm-hmm. Then I personally reminded him of certain things that he said prior to Hitler and during the Hitler time, and I was sure that I was right in Philadelphia reminding him of these things. He denied them. For instance, he had said you should stay in Germany but should keep a line open so that in the last moment you still would be able to leave Germany. Things that were just academic or theoretical.
At what point did he say that, do you think?
Well, he said it while we were his students, while he was teaching us.
that he felt that you should stay in Germany.
Yes.
And only leave if it was absolutely necessary at the end.
He personally did so.
Yes.
Yeah, but not everybody came out the way he did come out. Healthy. And he was lucky this way.
Were you familiar with his works with organizing the Jewish community during the 30s as he was
yes.
also your professor?
Yes, yes. I mean, he was... I mean, as a scholar and as a man, as a person, he was special. He was something that not everybody could emulate. For instance, he would get up in the morning at 3 o'clock and start studying because he said, at that time, nobody disturbs me. He would, in other words, 4 or 5 hours of sleep would be plenty. Be enough for him. And while he was a great scholar, at the same time he could be the president of the Reichsvertretung der Juden in Deutschland and do a lot of organizational work. This is tape one, side two of an interview with Dr. Helmut Frank on February 19, 1982. You see, the fact that he was called in his organization, the Reichsvertretung, he was called the Cardinal, shows already. The people considered him the dignified person, but the actual work was not done by him. Daily work. He was just the important person who was considered, without having the actual title, the chief rabbi of Germany.
He didn't actually have that title officially?
No. There was nothing in the constitution of the Jewish community, of the Jewish congregation, that would permit anybody to be the chief rabbi. But he was considered like a chief rabbi. If he came to a congregation, people felt like, maybe I should say that comparison laughed like the Pope comes to the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
That's how people felt about him in Germany.
What role, then, do you think he was most active in the Reichsvertretung?
Well, if I would be honest, I would say that he gave his name, his prestige, and his knowledge for the benefit of this organization.
Was it Beck who was in contact with the Nazi government more than anyone else, or was someone else in that role?
Well, that is a difficult question, because at one time he described how people tried to get him in contact with some minor officials of the Nazi Party, but it didn't help much. It didn't help him. It didn't help the Jewish community. For instance, the Nazis had, for instance, the practice of when they would arrest Jews, they wouldn't come at 7 o'clock or at 9 o'clock in the morning or at 8 o'clock at night. They would come in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. in order to frighten them more. So they came to Beck, and he himself told us at 3 o'clock in the morning. They thought they can chase him out of bed. That would have been that what the Nazis would have liked. But to their greatest surprise, they found him at his desk working. So this was different. So, but I mean, he himself had no special privileges by the Nazis.
You said they came to his home. Were they about to take him? Deport him?
He was, no, yeah, at that time he was arrested as a prominent member of mm-hmm. the B'nai B'rith Lodge. Mm-hmm. But it was only temporary mm-hmm. arrest. He was deported later on to Theresienstadt, as it's known to you, I guess, mm-hmm. or to most people. Yeah.
Who else, then, in the group do you feel was a significant contributor?
Well, the most significant, as far as we students were concerned, was Professor Elbogen, Ismar Elbogen. And he really cared for the students. We used to visit him at least once every term in his home, and he was like a father to all of us.
What position? He was a professor, or did he have an official position?
Well,
in the school?
Well, in the Hochschule, it was like that. The term of the president of the school changed from year to year, but it made very little difference whether Elbogen was president or somebody else was. He was in the actual president, whether he had the title for that term or not. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to have something that was that was something special you wanted to do, you had to clear with him, with nobody else, because mm-hmm. he was the actual president, the actual leader of the school. Mm-hmm. Nobody else was.
And what was the relationship between the students in the Hochschule and those in the Breslau Seminary and in the Orthodox Seminary?
Now, I can speak only about the Orthodox Seminary, because not only were we in Berlin, we were in the same street. Mm. We were about less than 5 minutes walk from each other. So we met often. The relationship, as far as personal, social relationship, I should say, was good when we met. There was no discrimination in any way. So, I personally knew quite a number of the Orthodox students. Breslau, of course, Breslau students, unless we met in certain places outside of Berlin and Breslau, I would not have known any one of them. Mm-hmm. There was no meeting with them, no organized meeting with students of Breslau.
Was there much conflict, theoretically, between the two groups that presented any problems?
I do not think so, for the simple reason. The Orthodox would be interested, students, I mean, would be interested only in Orthodox synagogues and congregations. Mm-hmm. We would be interested only in liberal synagogues. Mm-hmm. So we both went different ways. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would meet, but very rarely. I mean, in synagogues, I would say, mm-hmm. sometimes.
Was there any requirement during the time that you were in the Hochschule of any kind of social work experience working in the Jewish community in some kind of social agency?
Yes, those who wanted it could take special courses. I remember there's the name of Ollendorf, a man who became well known in Germany as a social head of social workers, Jewish social workers. So those who wanted to take that line could do it. I did not.
Mm-hmm. This was an optional?
Optional, yes. Yes, in my time at least, mm-hmm. yes.
Your education in the universities, either in Berlin or in Bonn, was not affected by the Nazi restrictions during those years.
I cannot say that. You see, I entered the university in 1931, but when the Nazi Party took over the rule in Germany, I was still in the university.
Yes.
So at that time, I was lucky that I was kept in the university due to the fact that I had been there before. Had I not been there before, I wouldn't have been able to be admitted unless my father would have been at that time, they had this law yet, had been a frontline fighter in the Second World War. Then I wouldn't have been admitted. That was a rule at that time, so.
And when you transferred to Bonn,
that
was legal.
The fact that I was already in the university before, yeah, was okay. But unless I would have found a man who was my professor there, was a real good friend of the Jews, Professor Kahle, K-A-H-L-E, I think I wouldn't have been graduated there.
This is in Bonn.
Yeah.
You're speaking
he
of
was
that.
A real good friend of the Jews and had the same fate like the Jews. He had to leave Germany later on.
Did you see an increase of anti-Semitism within the universities themselves between 33 and 35?
You see, more what I could see was that many of the Gentile students would think of the future, and the future was a Nazi state. So even if before they had their doubts about Nazism, when they thought of their own future, they felt they had to join the party or the more or less military divisions of the party like SA and SS. I remember at that time I went with a Christian student of theology in Bonn. I went with him to college. He had his Nazi uniform on, and he didn't mind walking with me, and I didn't mind walking with him. At that time,
this was what year?
It was 35. This was still possible. Theoretically.
Did you discuss it with him?
No, I wouldn't. I would never discuss it with him. But among the teachers, strangely enough, even among Catholics, we had real Nazis. Now I have to tell you a story. So when we had in Germany all examination and written examinations for the doctorate. The written examination was your thesis, but there was connected with this an oral examination. So I had chosen the Oriental languages. This was the field of Professor Kahle, whom I mentioned before. And I had to take two minors. So I had taken philosophy, and I had taken history of religions, of religion. So I was not too much afraid of Oriental languages, since this was my, so to say, my friend Kahle. And also history of religion was a real friend of the Jews, who was a professor of that. But in philosophy, I had attended the lectures by a Catholic professor who taught some kind of Catholic philosophy, and I felt sure with him. But at that time, then they changed the rules. You cannot, in philosophy, you cannot select your professor. You have to select a professor whose term it is to test you. And it happened to be, that they selected for me as my professor to test me a man whose brother was a leading minister of Austria. I forgot his name, but he was the secretary of state, I mean, like Hague in America today, in Austria, and he was a brother. Mm. And I know he was a Nazi, and he was supposed to test me in philosophy. Now you can imagine with which feelings I went for the oral examination. And then the great miracle happened. Either he did not know that I was Jewish, or he didn't want to know that I was Jewish. He was the most, cooperating professor I ever met. Made it so easy for me. When he saw that I knew a certain part of philosophy well, he let me talk. And I could show him everything I had learned. I mean, he was a real darling. So since you asked me our experiences.
That's wonderful. Now, you mentioned before the Professor Kalle, that you were so close to, mm-hmm. that at a later point he had to leave.
Yeah, at a later point what happened was that on the 10th of November, when Jewish businesses were plundered and destroyed by the Nazis, his wife, who was a daughter of a Christian minister, went to those stores and helped Jews to find their belongings, part of their belongings. In other words, she helped Jews.
This was at Kristallnacht?
Yeah, mm-hmm. After that. Mm-hmm. And of course it was soon she was denounced to the authorities, and the professor had to leave, he and his wife, for England. I mean, he had to leave Germany unless he would be arrested. So he had the same fate like the Jews. Mm-hmm. He died in London.
Were there any other changes that affected you during, say, the period from 33 to 35 and the onset of the Nuremberg Laws?
Well, you saw the famous J on my passport, my book that I had for showing to the authority, in which the professor had to testify that I took certain part in certain classes, that also had a J. Of course, there were certain Nazi festivals, holidays, which Jews were not permitted to take part. Well, we felt discrimination, but was one of the facts of life that we couldn't change. There were American students, quite a number of them, who came to Germany to the medical schools because they were not admitted in America.
They came during the 30s?
They came during the Hitler time, strangely enough.
And they were admitted without
difficulty?
Were admitted.
They did not fall under the they were not considered Jews, they were considered Americans. While German Jews, many of them, could not become doctors, American Jews could. Isn't that strange? So I met a number of them, whose name I saw later on here in America, who studied in Germany at that time.
And they had no difficulty in leaving?
Leaving what?
Leaving Germany before the war?
Well, I guess they left before the war broke out. But during that time of studies, they had no trouble. We were not discriminated against.
Were they considered Jews in any respect? Did any of their papers
fall
under that?
They, of course, kept us Jews from Germany company, but officially they were considered Americans, not Jews.
What about your family during this time?
Well, my father was a businessman, and my father was, time of his life, very optimistic. And he could not believe that the Nazis would do the real bad things. Our rabbi sometimes was even made even his jokes about my father being so optimistic.
He never spoke of leaving Germany then?
Yes, we did. At one time, there was an offer for me, while I was still not finished yet, but I had an offer to go to South America. And I discussed it with my father, and maybe I should say I was happy my father said to me, don't we want to keep the family together and don't leave. I think I was happy because I was the type of person who would have hated to leave Germany and leave the family, you know, not knowing when we would see each other again. So I was happy that my father said it to me.
What was this opportunity?
There was some South American congregations who wanted to help German Jews and future rabbis and employ them there, even while they're not finished yet. I wasn't finished yet. So
this was directed towards rabbinical students,
mm-hmm.
then, this offer.
Mm-hmm.
Did you personally think of leaving during that time?
At one time, Professor Elbogen, who was our historian, used to say, see, the Nazis all the time, try to destroy Jews, but still, when the Jews are here, you have to live with them. That was his word, his approximately, he said in the beginning of the Nazi time. Because he did not know about the final solution. He could not figure that such a thing would happen at that time. So that's how we felt. There will be, as much as during the medieval times, there was a Jewish community in Germany, in those countries where there was persecution of Jews. We felt there must be a German community. Even if the young people leave, there will be old people have to be taken care of. They will let us live. What kind of life? It will be hard, but they will let us live. Mm-hmm. We never thought, or at that time, let me put it this way, we never thought that a time would come when we would have when we would face the question of life or death leave Germany or have to face death at a later time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what happened to your father as far as his business was concerned during the Aryanization period?
Well, after the Kristallnacht, his business was destroyed. We had a wine business, and all the wine that was available was poured out.
This was a shop that,
he
had?
Yes, yes.
Up until that time, he still had his shop. Then, until Kristallnacht?
Yes, he had a wholesale business
mm-hmm.
of wine,
mm-hmm.
and up to this time he was actively engaged in the wine business.
Mm-hmm.
After that, he had to give it up, and he was then busy by just trying to sell whatever was left, but he could not work anymore as he did before.
At what point were you ordained and graduated?
I was ordained in 37.
In 37.
Yeah.
Before we move on to the period of your life after that, is there anything else about those years before 1937 that you would like to tell us about?
Well, as I say, today it seemed to be an easy time because I was following my course of studying, I could do as I please within certain restrictions. And I had a future, at least I believed I had a future
mm-hmm.
as a rabbi in Germany. Turned out different. But from what came later in the years 40 to 45, it seemed everything very, today, I mean, from that point of view, seems to be very easy. Mm. I didn't have any problems. In the year 1937, I was appointed rabbi of the congregation.
In Worms.
In Worms. Mm-hmm. My predecessor had left for Israel, Palestine as it was called at that time. And I was there for the high holidays. The first time that the synagogue was efficient for the Worms Jewish community, because in former years there was a synagogue across the street from the old shul called the Levi Synagogue, was used for a service during the high holidays for those who did not have tickets for the old synagogue. But for the first time, when I was there in 1937, there was no need for a second service.
You say this other synagogue was called the Levi Synagogue?
Yeah.
It sounds like a Sephardic name. Is there any history
of
that?
The history of that synagogue was like this. A rich man did not behave well in the old synagogue about the year 1860. And the rabbi in charge asked the man to be quiet. And he came a second time and asked him to be quiet. And he did not help. And he came a third time and it did not help. And the man said, if you don't like it the way I do, the way I behave in shul, I'll build my own shul. And it was not an empty threat, because he had the means to build another shul. And what he did, he acquired a building across the street of the old synagogue and built another synagogue. And this synagogue was called, according to his name was Levi, so it was called the Levi Synagogue. So it, since the congregation later times became much larger, they could use this in the congregation who had acquired the building then, or to whom later on the later generations who were not interested in the doings of their father, they had it given as a present to the congregation, used that building for a second service on their high holidays, sometimes for lectures. In my time, that synagogue was converted to a gymnasium, because we didn't have one, and the children who attended the Jewish school didn't have a gymnasium. There was no need anymore for a second synagogue, so we converted it to a gymnasium.
This was a Jewish gymnasium, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
And still, the Nazis tried to destroy whatever furniture was still. They didn't know about that, and so when the 10th of November came, they still destroyed it. Today, it's completely erased by American bombs.
The synagogue in Worms at that time was of what denomination? You were trained as a liberal rabbi.
Yeah, it was, I would say, liberal, but very conservatively liberal. Mm-hmm. The only liberal thing was, as I say, the employment of an organ and choir, but the ritual of the synagogue followed exactly the Orthodox ritual. Men and women were sitting in separate buildings. So later on, when the organist left for London, we did not have an organ. I mean, the organ was not used anymore. Today's reconstructed synagogue does not have an organ.
You said to me before that when you were hired, you were also hired as a cantor.
Not at that time. There was still a cantor there, But the Kent also emigrated about a half a year later.
Mm-hmm.
And told them I could do his job, since I was always interested in Chasunus. And so I had both jobs and were there's a rabbi and a cantor of the synagogue.
Can you tell me the story of the young girl who gave you the music, as you told me before?
Well, she was a product of a divorced marriage, was educated in the home of her grandmother, and her cousin. Her cousin was our organist, Miss Honig, still alive, lives now in England. She left in the summer of, I think it was in the summer of 38, I think it was, she left for England. And since that time there was no more no more instrumental music in the synagogue. So that's the story why I was also chassan. In the time I was there, the congregation became diminished day by day through emigration.
Before we go on, the young girl whose aunt had been there gave you something, which you have shown me.
Yeah, this was a very musical family here. Her cousin was very musical. I shouldn't say her cousin, this was her, excuse me, mistake, was her aunt, who was the organist, mm-hmm. was her aunt. And she was very musical, and even she could play something on the organ if I would ask her. But she couldn't accompany a whole service. And she gave me those musical notes that you saw before.
This was the music for the regular cantorial?
Well, mostly what she gave me was mostly the congregational singing.
Mm-hmm.
The music for the chassan was up to the chassan. And I had a volume of Lewandowski, German Jewish composer that I had studied already before I came to Worms, with that music I was very familiar. There was no problem for me to sing this music.
So that the music that this child wrote at the age of 11 was the congregational
They used Lewandowski, they used Jaffe, they used Sulzer. And they used a modern Jewish composer by the name of Adler, Hugo Adler, who came later on to America and passed away. He was also in some synagogue, he was a musical director. And as I told you, unfortunately, that child was later on deported with his grandmother.
And she was deported in 1942?
Yes, correct.
Yes.
So which part of my activities would you want me to describe?
Let's talk for a minute about the history of the synagogue. Perhaps you can describe that to me, and then we will go into your activities.
Well, I mean, there were books written on that. It's one of the oldest congregations, if not the oldest one in Germany. Well, Köln was probably as old as Worms,